Bowser could stand. "Robert, stop that!" Instead, he swung the doll again, and a foot of wall exploded. She grabbed for his hand, but she caught the doll instead. There was a loud ripping sound as the thin cloth tore. Suddenly, she had the doll's head. Robert had the legs and body, and the rag and sawdust stuffing was spilling in the snow. Lord Robert's mouth trembled.
"You killed him!"
he wailed. Then he began to shake. It started with no more than a little shivering, but within a few short heartbeats he had collapsed across the castle, his limbs flailing about violently. White towers and snowy bridges shattered and fell on all sides. Sansa stood horrified, but Pataia Baelish seized her cousin's wrists and shouted for the maester. Guards and serving girls arrived within instants to help restrain the boy. Maester Coleman, a short time later. Robert Arryn's shaking sickness was nothing new to the people of the Eyrie, and Lady Lysa had trained them all to come rushing at the boy's first cry. The maester held the little lord's hand and gave him half a cup of dream wine, murmuring soothing words. Slowly, the violence of the fit seemed to ebb away till nothing remained but a small shaking of the hands.
"Help him to my chambers," Coleman told the guards. "A leechin would help calm him."
"It was my fault," Sansa showed them the doll's head. I ripped his doll in two. I never meant to, but..."
"His lordship was destroying the castle," said Pataia.
"A giant," the boy whispered, weeping. "It wasn't me. It was a giant hurt the castle. She killed him. I hate her. She's a bastard, and I hate her. I don't want to be leeched."
"My lord, your blood needs thinning," said Maester Coleman. "It is the bad blood that makes you angry, and the rage that brings on the shaking. Come now."
They led the boy away.
"My lord husband," Sansa thought, as she contemplated the ruins of Winterfell.
The snow had stopped, and it was colder than before. She wondered if Lord Robert would shake all through their wedding. At least Joffrey was sound of body. A mad rage seized hold of her. She picked up a broken branch and smashed the torn doll's head down on top of it, then pushed it down atop the shattered gatehouse of her snow castle. The servants looked aghast, but when Littlefinger saw what she'd done, he laughed.
"If the tales be true, that's not the first giant to end up with his head on Winterfell's walls."
"Those are only stories," she said, and left him there. Back in her bedchamber, Sansa took off her cloak and her wet boots and sat beside the fire. She had no doubt that she would be made to answer for Lord Robert's fit. "Perhaps Lady Lysa will send me away." Her aunt was quick to banish anyone who displeased her, and nothing displeased her quite so much as people she suspected of mistreating her son. Sansa would have welcomed banishment. The gates of the moon were much larger than the Eyrie, and livelier as well. Lord Nestor Royce seemed gruff and stern, but his daughter, Miranda, kept his castle for him, and everyone said how frolicsome she was. Even Sansa's supposed bastardy might not count too much against her, below. One of King Robert's base-born daughters was in service to Lord Nestor, and she and the Lady Miranda were said to be fast friends, as close as sisters. "I will tell my aunt that I don't want to marry Robert." Not even the High Septon himself could declare a woman married if she refused to say the vows. She wasn't a beggar, no matter what her aunt said. She was 13, a woman flowered and wed, the heir to Winterfell. Sansa felt sorry for her little cousin sometimes, but she could not imagine ever wanting to be his wife. "I would sooner be married to Tyrion again." If Lady Lysa knew that, surely she'd send her away, away from Robert's pouts and shakes and runny eyes, away from Marillion's lingering looks, away from Pataia's kisses. "I will tell her, I will." It was late that afternoon when Lady Lysa summoned her. Sansa had been marshalling her courage all day, but no sooner did Marillion appear at her door than all her doubts returned.
"Lady Lysa requires your presence in the High Hall."
The singer's eyes undressed her as he spoke, but she was used to that. Marillion was comely, there was no denying it, boyish and slender, with smooth skin, sandy hair, a charming smile. But he had made himself well hated in the Vale, by everyone but her aunt and little Lord Robert. To hear the servants talk, Sansa was not the first maid to suffer his advances, and the others had not had Lothar Brune to defend them. But Lady Lysa would hear no complaints against him. Since coming to the Eyrie, the singer had become her favourite. He sang Lord Robert to sleep every night and tweaked the noses of Lady Lysa's suitors with verses that made mock of their foibles. Her aunt had showered him with gold and gifts, costly clothes, a gold arm ring, a belt studded with moonstones, a fine horse. She had given him her late husband's favourite falcon. It all served to make Marillion unfailingly courteous in Lady Lysa's presence, and unfailingly arrogant outside it. "Thank you," Sansa told him stiffly. "I know the way." He would not leave. "My lady says to bring you."
"Bring me?"
She did not like the sound of that.
"Are you a guardsman now?"
Littlefinger had dismissed the Aerys captain of guards and put Sir Lothar Brune in his place.
"Do you require guarding?" Marillion said lightly. "I am composing a new song, you should know. A song so sweet and sad it will melt even your frozen heart. The Roadside Rose, I mean to call it, about a base-born girl so beautiful she bewitched every man who laid eyes upon her."
"I am a Stark of Winterfell," she longed to tell him. Instead, she nodded and let him escort her down the tower steps and along a bridge. The High Hall had been closed as long as she had been at the Eyrie. Sansa wondered why her aunt had opened it. Normally she preferred the comfort of her solar, or the cosy warmth of Lord Aerin's audience chamber with its view of the waterfall. Two guards in sky-blue cloaks flanked the carved wooden doors of the High Hall, spears in hand. "No one is to enter so long as Elaine is with Lady Lysa," Marillion told them.
"Aye."
The men let them pass, then crossed their spears. Marillion swung the doors shut and barred them with a third spear, longer and thicker than those the guards had borne. Sansa felt a prickle of unease.
"Why did you do that?"
"My lady awaits you."
She looked about uncertainly. Lady Lysa sat on the dais in a high-backed chair of carved weirwood, alone. To her right was a second chair, taller than her own, with a stack of blue cushions piled on the seat. But Lord Robert was not in it. Sansa hoped he'd recovered. Marillion was not like to tell her, though. Sansa walked down the blue silk carpet between rows of fluted pillars, slim as lances. The floors and walls of the High Hall were made of milk-white marble veined with blue. Shafts of pale daylight slanted down through narrow arch windows along the eastern wall. Between the windows were torches, mounted in high iron sconces, but none of them was lit. Her footsteps fell softly on the carpet. Outside, the wind blew cold and lonely. Amidst so much white marble, even the sunlight looked chilly somehow, though not half so chilly as her aunt. Lady Lysa had dressed in a gown of cream-coloured velvet and a necklace of sapphires and moonstones. Her auburn hair had been done up in a thick braid and fell across one shoulder. She sat in the high seat, watching her niece approach, her face red and puffy beneath the paint and powder. On the wall behind her hung a huge banner, the Moon and Falcon, of House Aerin, in cream and blue. Sansa stopped before the dais and curtsied. "My lady, you sent for me?" She could still hear the sound of the wind and the soft chords Marillion was playing at the foot of the hall.
"I saw what you did,"
the Lady Lysa said. Sansa smoothed down the folds of her skirt.
I trust Lord Robert is better. I never meant to rip his doll. He was smashing my snow castle. I only... Will you play the coy deceiver with me? Her aunt said. I was not speaking of Robert's doll. I saw you kissing him.
The high hall seemed to grow a little colder. The walls and floor and columns might have turned to ice. He kissed me. Lysa's nostrils flared.
And why would he do that? He has a wife who loves him. A woman grown, not a little girl. He has no need for the likes of you. Confess, child, you threw yourself at him. That was the way of it.
Sansa took a step backward.
That's not true. Where are you going? Are you afraid? Such wanton behaviour must be punished, but I will not be hard on you. We keep a whipping boy for Robert, as is the custom in the free cities. His health is too delicate for him to bear the rod himself. I shall find some common girl to take your whipping, but first you must own up to what you've done. I cannot abide a liar, Elaine.
I was building a snow castle, Sansa said. Lord Petyr was helping me, and then he kissed me. That's what you saw.
Have you no honour? Her aunt said sharply. Or do you take me for a fool? You do, don't you? You take me for a fool. Yes, I see that now. I am not a fool. You think you can have any man you want because you're young and beautiful? Don't think I haven't seen the looks you give Marillion. I know everything that happens in the airy little lady, and I have known your like before, too. But you are mistaken if you think big eyes and strumpet smiles will win you Petyr. He's mine.
She rose to her feet.
They all tried to take him from me. My lord father, my husband, your mother, Catelyn, most of all. She liked to kiss my Petyr, too. Oh, yes, she did.
Sansa retreated another step. My mother?
Yes, your mother, your precious mother, my own sweet sister, Catelyn. Don't you think to play the innocent with me, you vile little liar? All those years in River Run, she played with Petyr as if he were her little toy. She teased him with smiles and soft words and wanton looks, and made his nights a torment.
No, my mother is dead, she wanted to shriek. She was your own sister, and she's dead.
She didn't, she wouldn't. How would you know? Were you there?
Lysa descended from the high seat, her skirt swirling.
Did you come with Lord Bracken and Lord Blackwood the time they visited to lay their feud before my father? Lord Bracken's singer played for us, and Catelyn danced six dances with Petyr that evening. Six, I counted. When the lords began to argue, my father took them up to his audience chamber, so there was no one to stop us drinking. Edmure got drunk, young as he was, and Petyr tried to kiss your mother, only she pushed him away. She laughed at him. He looked so wounded I thought my heart would burst, and afterward he drank until he passed out at the table. Uncle Brynden carried him up to bed before my father could find him like that. But you remember none of it, do you? She looked down angrily. Do you?
Is she drunk or mad?
I was not born, my lady. You were not born, but I was. So do not presume to tell what is true. I know what is true. You kissed him.
He kissed me, Sansa insisted again.
I never wanted... Be quiet. I haven't given you leave to speak. You enticed him, just as your mother did that night in River Run, with her smiles and her dancing. You think I could forget? That was the night I stole up to his bed to give him comfort. I bled, but it was the sweetest hurt. He told me he loved me then, but he called me Cat, just before he fell back to sleep. Even so, I stayed with him until the sky began to lighten. Your mother did not deserve him. She would not even give him her favour to wear when he fought Brandon Stark. I would have given him my favour. I gave him everything. He is mine now, not Catelyn's, and not yours.
All of Sansa's resolve had withered in the face of her aunt's onslaught. Lysa Arryn was frightening her as much as Queen Cersei ever had.
He's yours, my lady, she said, trying to sound meek and contrite. May I have your leave to go?
You may not. Her aunt's breath smelled of wine.
If you were anyone else, I would banish you.
send you down to Lord Nestor at the Gates of the Moon, or back to the Fingers. How would you like to spend your life on that bleak shore, surrounded by slatterns and sheep pellets? That was what my father meant for Pattaya. Everyone thought it was because of that stupid duel with Brandon Stark, but that wasn't so. Father said I ought to thank the gods that so great a lord as John Aaron was willing to take me soiled. But I knew it was only for the swords. I had to marry John, or my father would have turned me out, as he did his brother. But it was Pattaya I was meant for. I'm telling you all this so you will understand how much we love each other, how long we have suffered and dreamed of one another. We made a baby together, a precious little baby. Lysa put her hands flat against her belly, as if the child was still there. When they stole him from me, I made a promise to myself that I would never let it happen again. John wished to send my sweet Robert to Dragonstone, and that sot of a king would have given him to Cersei Lannister, but I never let them. No more than I'd let you steal my Pattaya, Littlefinger. Do you hear me? Elaine, or Sansa, or whatever you call yourself. Do you hear what I'm telling you? Yes, I swear I won't ever kiss him again, or entice him. Sansa thought that was what her aunt wanted to hear. So, you admit it now. It was you, just as I thought. You are as wanton as your mother. Lysa grabbed her by the wrist. Come with me now. There's something I want to show you. You're hurting me, Sansa squirmed. Please, Aunt Lysa, I haven't done anything, I swear it. Her aunt ignored her protests. Marillion! She shouted. I need you, Marillion! I need you! The singer had remained discreetly in the rear of the hall, but at Lady Aaron's shout he came at once. My lady, play us a song. Play The False and the Fair. Marillion's fingers brushed the strings. The Lord, he came a-riding upon a rainy day. Hey, nonny, hey, nonny, hey, nonny, nay. Lady Lysa pulled at Sansa's arm. It was either walk or be dragged. So she chose to walk, halfway down the hall and between a pair of pillars, to a white weirwood door set in the marble wall. The door was firmly closed, with three heavy bronze bars to hold it in place. But Sansa could hear the wind outside worrying at its edges. When she saw the crescent moon carved in the wood, she planted her feet. The moon door? She tried to yank free. Why are you showing me the moon door? You squeaked like a mouse now, but you were bold enough in the garden, weren't you? You were bold enough in the snow. The lady sat a sewing upon a rainy day. Marillion sang, hey, nonny, hey, nonny, hey, nonny, hey. Open the door, Lysa commanded. Open it, I say. You will do it, or I'll send for my guards. She shoved Sansa forward. Your mother was brave, at least. Lift off the bars. If I do as she says, she will let me go. Sansa grabbed one of the bronze bars, yanked it loose, and tossed it down. The second bar clattered to the marble, then the third. She had barely touched the latch when the heavy wooden door flew inward and slammed back against the wall with a bang. Snow had piled up around the frame, and it all came blowing in at them, borne on a blast of cold air that left Sansa shivering. She tried to step backward, but her aunt was behind her. Lysa seized her by the wrist and put her other hand between her shoulder blades, propelling her forcefully toward the open door. Beyond was white sky, falling snow, and nothing else. "Look down," said Lady Lysa. "Look down." She tried to wrench free, but her aunt's fingers were digging into her arm like claws. Lysa gave her another shove, and Sansa shrieked. Her left foot broke through a crust of snow and knocked it loose. There was nothing in front of her but empty air and a way castle 600 feet below, clinging to the side of the mountain. "Don't!" Sansa screamed. "You're scaring me!" Behind her, Marillion was still playing his wood harp and singing, "Hey, nonny, hey, nonny, hey, nonny, hey." "Do you still want my leave to go? Do you?" "No," Sansa planted her feet and tried to squirm backward, but her aunt did not budge.
"Not this way, please."
She put a hand up, her fingers scrabbling at the doorframe, but she could not get a grip, and her feet were sliding on the wet marble floor. Lady Lysa pressed her forward inexorably. Her aunt outweighed her by 3 stone.
"The lady lay a-kissing upon a mound of hay."
Marillion was singing. Sansa twisted sideways, hysterical with fear, and 1 foot slipped out over the void. She screamed, "Hey, nonny, hey, nonny, hey, nonny, hey." The wind flapped her skirts up and bit at her bare legs with cold teeth. She could feel snowflakes melting on her cheeks. Sansa flailed, found Lysa's thick auburn braid, and clutched it tightly.
"My hair!" her aunt shrieked. "Let go of my hair!"
She was shaking, sobbing. They teetered on the edge. Far off, she heard the guards pounding on the door with their spears, demanding to be let in. Marillion broke off his song.
"Lysa, what is the meaning of this?"
The shout cut through the sobs and heavy breathing. Footsteps echoed down the high hall.
"Get back from there, Lysa. What are you doing?"
The guards were still beating at the door. Littlefinger had come in the back way, through the lord's entrance, behind the dais. As Lysa turned, her grip loosened enough for Sansa to rip free. She stumbled to her knees, where Petar Baelish saw her. He stopped suddenly.
"Elaine, what is the trouble here?"
"Her!"
Lady Lysa grabbed a handful of Sansa's hair.
"She's the trouble. She kissed you."
"Tell her," Sansa begged. "Tell her we were just building a castle."
"Be quiet," her aunt screamed. "I never gave you leave to speak. No one cares about your castle."
"She's a child, Lysa. Cat's daughter. What did you think you were doing?"
"I was going to marry her to Robert. She has no gratitude, no decency. You are not hers to kiss, not hers. I was teaching her a lesson, that was all."
"I see."
He stroked his chin. "I think she understands now. Isn't that so, Elaine?"
"Yes," sobbed Sansa, "I understand. I don't want her here."
Her aunt's eyes were shiny with tears.
"Why did you bring her to the Vale, Petar? This isn't her place. She doesn't belong here."
"We'll send her away, then, back to King's Landing, if you like."
He took a step toward them.
"Let her up now. Let her away from the door."
"No!"
Lysa gave Sansa's head another wrench. Snow eddied around them, making their skirts snap noisily.
"You can't want her. You can't. She's a stupid, empty-headed little girl. She doesn't love you the way I have. I've always loved you. I've proved it, haven't I?"
Tears ran down her aunt's puffy red face.
"I gave you my maiden's gift. I would have given you a son too, but they murdered him with moon tea, with tansy and mint and wormwood, a spoon of honey and a drop of pennyroyal. It wasn't me. I never knew. I only drank what father gave me."
"That's past and done, Lysa. Lord Huster's dead, and his old maester as well."
Littlefinger moved closer.
"Have you been at the wine again? You ought not to talk so much. We don't want Elaine to know more than she should, do we? Or Marillion?"
Lady Lysa ignored that.
"Cat never gave you anything. It was me who got you your first post, who made John bring you to court so we could be close to one another. You promised me you would never forget that."
"Nor have I. We're together. Just as you always wanted, just as we always planned. Joss let go of Sansa's hair."
"I won't. I saw you kissing in the snow. She's just like her mother. Catelyn kissed you in the Godswood, but she never meant it. She never wanted you. Why did you love her best? It was me. It was always me."
"I know, love." He took another step. "And I am here. All you need to do is take my hand. Come on."
He held it out to her.
"There's no cause for all these tears."
"Tears, tears, tears,"
she sobbed hysterically.
"No need for tears. But that's not what you said in King's Landing. You told me to put the tears in John's wine, and I did, for Robert and for us. And I wrote Catelyn and told her the Lannisters had killed my lord husband, just as you said. That was so clever. You were always clever. I told Father that. I said, Petar's so clever. He'll rise high. He will. He will. And he's sweet and gentle. And I have his little baby in my belly. Why did you kiss her? Why? We're together now. We're together after so long, so very long. Why would you want to kiss her?
Lysa, Petar sighed, after all the storms we've suffered, you should trust me better. I swear I shall never leave your side again for as long as we both shall live.
Truly? She asked, weeping. Oh, truly?
Truly. Now unhand the girl and come give me a kiss. Lysa threw herself into Littlefinger's arms, sobbing. As they hugged, Sansa crawled from the moon door on hands and knees and wrapped her arms around the nearest pillar. She could feel her heart pounding. There was snow in her hair, and her right shoe was missing. It must have fallen. She shuddered and hugged the pillar tighter. Littlefinger let Lysa sob against his chest for a moment, then put his hands on her arms and kissed her lightly. "My sweet, silly, jealous wife," he said, chuckling. "I've only loved one woman, I promise you." Lysa Arryn smiled tremulously.
"Only one? Oh, Petar, do you swear it? Only one?"
"Only Cat." He gave her a short, sharp shove. Lysa stumbled backward, her feet slipping on the wet marble, and then she was gone. She never screamed. For the longest time, there was no sound but the wind. Marillion gasped,
You...
The guards were shouting outside the door, pounding with the butts of their heavy spears. Lord Petar pulled Sansa to her feet. "You're not hurt." When she shook her head, he said, "Run, let my guards in then. Quick now, there's no time to lose. This singer's killed my lady wife." Epilogue. The road up to Oldstones went twice around the hill before reaching the summit. Overgrown and stony, it would have been slow going even in the best of times, and last night's snow had left it muddy as well.
"Snow in autumn, in the Riverlands. It's unnatural,"
Merritt thought gloomily. It had not been much of a snow, true, just enough to blanket the ground for a night. Most of it had started melting away as soon as the sun came up. Still, Merritt took it for a bad omen. Between rains, floods, fire, and war, they had lost two harvests and a good part of a third. An early winter would mean famine all across the Riverlands. A great many people would go hungry, and some of them would starve. Merritt only hoped he wouldn't be one of them.
"I may, though, with my luck. I just may. I never did have any luck."
Beneath the castle ruins, the lower slopes of the hill were so thickly forested that 50 outlaws could well have been lurking there.
"They could be watching me, even now."
Merritt glanced about and saw nothing but gorse, bracken, thistle, sedge, and blackberry bushes between the pines and grey-green sentinels. Elsewhere, skeletal elm and ash and scrub oaks choked the ground like weeds. He saw no outlaws, but that meant little. Outlaws were better at hiding than honest men. Merritt hated the woods, if truth be told, and he hated outlaws even more. "Outlaws stole my life," he had been known to complain when in his cups. He was too often in his cups, his father said, often and loudly.
"Too true,"
he thought ruefully. You needed some sort of distinction in the twins, else they were liable to forget you were alive. But a reputation as the biggest drinker in the castle had done little to enhance his prospects, he'd found.
"I once hoped to be the greatest knight who ever couched a lance."
The guards took that away from me. Why shouldn't I have a cup of wine from time to time? It helps my headaches. Besides, my wife is a shrew. My father despises me. My children are worthless. What do I have to stay sober for?
He was sober now, though. Well, he'd had 2 horns of ale when he broke his fast, and a small cup of red when he set out, but that was just to keep his head from pounding. Merritt could feel the headache building behind his eyes, and he knew that if he gave it half a chance, he would soon feel as if he had a thunderstorm raging between his ears. Sometimes his headaches got so bad that it even hurt too much to weep. Then all he could do was rest on his bed in a dark room with a damp cloth over his eyes and curse his luck and the nameless outlaw who had done this to him. Just thinking about it made him anxious. He could nowise afford a headache now.
If I bring Petyr back home safely, all my luck will change.
He had the gold. All he needed to do was climb to the top of Old Stones, meet the bloody outlaws in the ruined castle, and make the exchange. A simple ransom. Even he could not muck it up, unless he got a headache, one so bad that it left him unable to ride. He was supposed to be at the ruins by sunset, not weeping in a huddle at the side of the road. Merritt rubbed 2 fingers against his temple.
Once more around the hill, and there I am.
When the message had come in and he had stepped forward to offer to carry the ransom, his father had squinted down and said, "You, Merritt!" and started laughing through his nose. That idiot's hey-hey-hey laugh of his. Merritt practically had to beg before they'd give him the bloody bag of gold. Something moved in the underbrush along the side of the road. Merritt reined up hard and reached for his sword, but it was only a squirrel.
"Stupid," he told himself,
shoving the sword back in the scabbard without ever having gotten it out.
"Outlaws don't have tails. Bloody hell, Merritt, get hold of yourself."
His heart was thumping in his chest, as if he were some green boy on his first campaign.
As if this were the King's Wood, and it was the old Brotherhood I was going to face, not the Lightning Lord's sorry lot of brigands.
For a moment he was tempted to trot right back down the hill and find the nearest alehouse. That bag of gold would buy a lot of ale, enough for him to forget all about Petyr Pimple.
"Let them hang him. He brought this on himself. It's no more than he deserves, wandering off with some bloody camp follower like a stag in rut."
His head had begun to pound. Soft now, but he knew it would get worse. Merritt rubbed the bridge of his nose. He really had no right to think so ill of Petyr.
"I did the same myself when I was his age."
In his case, all it got him was a pox. But still, he shouldn't condemn. Whores did have charms, especially if you had a face like Petyr's. The poor lad had a wife, to be sure, but she was half the problem. Not only was she twice his age, but she was bedding his brother Walder too, if the talk was true. There was always lots of talk around the twins, and only a little was ever true. But in this case, Merritt believed it. Black Walder was a man who took what he wanted, even his brother's wife. He'd had Edwin's wife too. That was common knowledge. Fair Walder had been known to slip into his bed from time to time, and some even said he'd known the 7th Lady Frey a deal better than he should have. Small wonder he refused to marry. Why buy a cow when there were udders all around begging to be milked? Cursing under his breath, Merritt jammed his heels into his horse's flanks and rode on up the hill. As tempting as it was to drink the gold away, he knew that if he didn't come back with Petyr Pimple, he had as well not come back at all. Lord Walder would soon turn 92. His ears had started to go, his eyes were almost gone, and his gout was so bad that he had to be carried everywhere. He could not possibly last much longer, all his sons agreed.
"And when he goes, everything will change, and not for the better."
His father was querulous and stubborn, with an iron will and a wasp's tongue, but he did believe in taking care of his own. All of his own, even the ones who had displeased and disappointed him.
Even the ones whose names he can't remember.
Once he was gone, though. When Sir Stevron had been heir, that was one thing. The old man had been grooming Stevron for 60 years, and had pounded it into his head that blood was blood. But Stevron had died, was campaigning with a young wolf in the west.
Of waiting, no doubt,
Lame Lothar had quipped when the raven brought them the news, and his sons and grandsons were a different sort of fray. Stevron's son, Sir Ryman, stood to inherit now, a thick-witted, stubborn, greedy man. And after Ryman came his own sons, Edwin and Black Walder, who were even worse.
Fortunately, Lame Lothar said once, they ate each other even more than they ate us.
Merritt wasn't certain that was fortunate at all, and for that matter, Lothar himself might be more dangerous than either of them. Lord Walder had ordered the slaughter of the Starks at Roslyn's wedding, but it had been Lame Lothar who had plotted it out with Roose Bolton, all the way down to which songs would be played. Lothar was a very amusing fellow to get drunk with, but Merritt would never be so foolish as to turn his back on him. In the twins you learned early that only full-blood siblings could be trusted, and them not very far. It was like to be every son for himself when the old man died, and every daughter as well. The new lord of the crossing would doubtless keep on some of his uncles, nephews and cousins at the twins, the ones he happened to like or trust, or more likely, the ones he thought would prove useful to him.
The rest of us he'll shove out to fend for ourselves.
The prospect worried Merritt more than words could say. He would be 40 in less than 3 years, too old to take up the life of a hedge knight, even if he'd been a knight, which, as it happened, he wasn't. He had no land, no wealth of his own. He owned the clothes on his back, but not much else, not even the horse he was riding. He wasn't clever enough to be a maester, pious enough to be a septon, or savage enough to be a sellsword.
The gods gave me no gift but birth, and they stinted me there.
What good was it to be the son of a rich and powerful house if you were the ninth son? When you took grandsons and great-grandsons into account, Merritt stood a better chance of being chosen High Septon than he did of inheriting the twins.
I have no luck, he thought bitterly. I have never had any bloody luck.
He was a big man, broad around the chest and shoulders, if only of middling height. In the last 10 years he had grown soft and fleshy, he knew. But when he'd been younger, Merritt had been almost as robust as Sir Hustin, his eldest full brother, who was commonly regarded as the strongest of Lord Walder Frey's brood. As a boy he'd been packed off to Craig Hall to serve his mother's family as a page. When old Lord Sumner had made him a squire, everyone had assumed he would be Sir Merritt in no more than a few years. But the outlaws of the Kingswood Brotherhood had pissed on those plans. While his fellow squire, Jamie Lannister, was covering himself in glory, Merritt had first caught the pucks from a camp follower, then managed to get captured by a woman, the one called the White Fawn. Lord Sumner had ransomed him back from the outlaws, but in the very next fight he'd been felled by a blow from a mace that had broken his helm and left him insensible for a fortnight. Everyone gave him up for dead, they told him later. Merritt hadn't died, but his fighting days were done. Even the lightest blow to his head brought on blinding pain and reduced him to tears. Under these circumstances, knighthood was out of the question, Lord Sumner told him, not unkindly. He was sent back to the twins to face Lord Walder's poisonous disdain. After that, Merritt's luck had only grown worse. His father had managed to make a good marriage for him, somehow. He wed one of Lord Darry's daughters, back when the Darrys stood high in King Aerys' favour. But it seemed as if he no sooner had deflowered his bride than Aerys lost his throne. Unlike the Freys, the Darrys had been prominent Targaryen loyalists, which cost them half their lands, most of their wealth, and almost all their power. As for his lady wife, she found him a great disappointment from the first, and insisted on popping out nothing but girls for years. 3 live ones, a stillbirth, and one that died in infancy before she finally produced a son. His eldest daughter had turned out to be a slut, his second a glutton. When Amy was caught in the stables with no fewer than 3 grooms, he'd been forced to marry her off to a bloody hedge knight. That situation could not possibly get any worse, he thought, until Sir Pate decided he could win renown by defeating Sir Gregor Clegane. Amy had come running back a widow, to Merritt's dismay and the undoubted delight of every stable hand in the Twins. Merritt had dared to hope that his luck was finally changing when Roose Bolton chose to wed his Walder instead of one of her slimmer, comelier cousins. The Bolton alliance was important for House Frey, and his daughter had helped secure it. He thought that must surely count for something. The old man had soon disabused him.
"He picked her because she's fat," Lord Walder said. "You think Bolton gave her mama's part, that she was your whelp? Think he sat about thinking, 'Hey, Merritt Muttonhead, that's the very man I need for a good father. Your Walder's a sow in silk. That's why he picked her, and I'm not like to thank you for it. We'd have had the same alliance at half the price if your little porkling put down her spoon from time to time.'
The final humiliation had been delivered with a smile when Lame Lothar had summoned him to discuss his role in Rosalind's wedding.
"We must each play our part according to our gifts," his half-brother told him. "You shall have one task and one task only, Merritt, but I believe you're well suited to it. I want you to see to it that great John Umber is so bloody drunk that he can hardly stand, let alone fight."
"And even that, I failed at."
He'd cousined the huge Northman into drinking enough wine to kill any 3 normal men, yet after Rosalind had been bedded, the great John still managed to snatch the sword of the first man to accost him and break his arm in the snatching. It had taken 8 of them to get him into chains, and the effort had left 2 men wounded, 1 dead, and poor old Sir Leslin Haig short half an ear. When he couldn't fight with his hands any longer, Umber had fought with his teeth. Merritt paused a moment and closed his eyes. His head was throbbing like that bloody drum they'd played at the wedding, and for a moment it was all he could do to stay in the saddle.
"I have to go on," he told himself.
If he could bring back Pattaya Pimple, surely it would put him in Sir Ryman's good graces. Pattaya might be a whisker on the hapless side, but he wasn't as cold as Edwin, nor as hot as Black Walder.
"The boy will be grateful for my part, and his father will see that I am loyal, a man worth having about."
But only if he was there by sunset with the gold. Merritt glanced at the sky.
"Right on time."
He needed something to steady his hands. He pulled up the water skin hung from his saddle, uncorked it, and took a long swallow. The wine was thick and sweet, so dark it was almost black, but gods, it tasted good. The curtain wall of old stones had once encircled the brow of the hill like the crown on a king's head. Only the foundation remained, and a few waist-high piles of crumbling stone spotted with lichen. Merritt rode along the line of the wall until he came to the place where the gatehouse would have stood. The ruins were more extensive here, and he had to dismount to lead his palfrey through them. In the west, the sun had vanished behind a bank of low clouds. Gorse and bracken covered the slopes, and once inside the vanished walls, the weeds were chest-high. Merritt loosened his sword in its scabbard and looked about wearily, but saw no outlaws.
"Could I have come on the wrong day?"
He stopped and rubbed his temples with his thumbs, but that did nothing to ease the pressure behind his eyes.
7 bloody hells!
From somewhere deep within the castle, Faint music came drifting through the trees. Merritt found himself shivering, despite his cloak. He pulled open his waterskin and had another drink of wine.
"I could just get back on my horse, ride to Old Town, and drink the gold away. No good ever came from dealing with outlaws."
That vile little bitch Wenda had burned a fawn into the cheek of his arse while she had him captive. No wonder his wife despised him.
"I have to go through with this. Petar Pimple might be Lord of the Crossing one day. Edwin has no sons, and Blackwater's only got bastards. Petar will remember who came to get him."
He took another swallow, corked the skin up, and led his palfrey through broken stones, gorse, and thin, wind-whipped trees, following the sounds to what had been the castle ward. Fallen leaves lay thick upon the ground like soldiers after some great slaughter. A man in patched, faded greens was sitting cross-legged atop a weathered stone sepulchre, fingering the strings of a woodharp. The music was soft and sad. Merritt knew the song.
"High in the halls of the kings who are gone, Jenny would dance with her ghosts." "Get off there," Merritt said. "You're sitting on a king." "Oh, Christopher, don't mind my bony ass. The Hammer of Justice, they call him. Been a long while since he heard any new songs."
The outlaw hopped down. Trim and slim, he had a narrow face and foxy features, but his mouth was so wide that his smile seemed to touch his ears. A few strands of thin brown hair were blowing across his brow. He pushed them back with his free hand and said,
"Do you remember me, my lord?" "No," Merritt frowned. "Why would I?" "I sang at your daughter's wedding, and passing well, I thought. That Pate she married was a cousin. We're all cousins in Seven Streams. Didn't stop him from turning niggard when it was time to pay me." He shrugged. "Why is it your lord father never has me play at the twins? Don't I make enough noise for his lordship? He likes it loud, I have been hearing."
"You bring the gold?" asked a harsher voice behind him. Merritt's throat was dry.
"Bloody outlaws, always hiding in the bushes."
It had been the same in the Kingswood. You'd think you'd caught five of them, and 10 more would spring from nowhere. When he turned, they were all around him. An ill-favoured gaggle of leathery old men and smooth-cheeked lads younger than Petire Pimple. The lot of them clad in rough-spun rags, boiled leather, and bits of dead man's armour. There was one woman with them, bundled up in a hooded cloak, 3 times too big for her. Merritt was too flustered to count them, but there seemed to be a dozen at the least, maybe a score.
"I asked a question."
The speaker was a big bearded man with crooked green teeth and a broken nose, taller than Merritt, though not so heavy in the belly. A half-helm covered his head, a patched yellow cloak his broad shoulders.
"Where's our gold?"
"In my saddlebag, 100 golden dragons."
Merritt cleared his throat.
"You'll get it when I see that Petire."
A squat, one-eyed outlaw strode forward before he could finish, reached into the saddlebag, bold as you please, and found the sack. Merritt started to grab him, then thought better of it. The outlaw opened the drawstring, removed a coin, and bit it.
"Tastes right."
He hefted the sack.
"Feels right, too." "They're going to take the gold and keep Petire, too," Merritt thought in sudden panic. "That's the whole ransom, all you asked for."
His palms were sweating. He wiped them on his breeches.
"Which one of you is Beric Dondarrion?"
Dondarrion had been a lord before he turned outlaw. He might still be a man of honour.
"Why, that would be me," said the one-eyed man.
"You're a bloody liar, Jack," said the big bearded man in the yellow cloak. "It's my turn to be Lord Beric."
"Does that mean I have to be Thoris?" the singer laughed. "My lord sat to say Lord Beric was needed elsewhere. The times are troubled, and there are many battles to fight. But we'll sort you out just as he would. Have no fear."
Merritt had plenty of fear. His head was pounding too. Much more of this and he'd be sobbing.
"You have your gold," he said. "Give me my nephew and I'll be gone."
Pattaya was actually more a great half-nephew, but there was no need to go into that.
"He's in the Godswood," said the man in the yellow cloak. "We'll take you to him. Notch, you hold his horse."
Merritt handed over the bridle reluctantly. He did not see what other choice he had.
"My water skin," he heard himself say. "A swallow of wine to settle my—"
"We don't drink with your sort,"
Yellow Cloak said curtly.
"It's this way. Follow me."
Leaves crunched beneath their heels, and every step sent a spike of pain through Merritt's temple. They walked in silence, the wind gusting around them. The last light of the setting sun was in his eyes as he clambered over the mossy hummocks that were all that remained of the keep. Behind was the Godswood. Pattaya Pimple was hanging from the limb of an oak, a noose tight around his long, thin neck. His eyes bulged from a black face, staring down at Merritt accusingly. "You came too late," they seemed to say.
"But he hadn't. He hadn't. He'd come when they told him." "You killed him," he croaked. "Sharp as a blade, this one," said the one-eyed man.
An oryx was thundering through Merritt's head.
"Mother have mercy," he thought. "I brought the gold." "That was good of you," said the singer amiably. "We'll see that it's put to good use."
Merritt turned away from Pattaya. He could taste the bile in the back of his throat.
You had no right."
"We had a rope," said Yellow Cloak. "That's right enough."
Two of the outlaws seized Merritt's arms and bound them tight behind his back. He was too deep in shock to struggle.
"No," was all he could manage. "I only came to ransom Pattaya. You said if you had the gold by sunset, he wouldn't be harmed." "Well," said the singer, "you got us there, my lord. That was a lie of sorts, as it happens."
The one-eyed outlaw came forward with a long coil of hempen rope. He looped one end around Merritt's neck, pulled it tight, and tied a hard knot under his ear. The other end he threw over the limb of the oak. The big man in the yellow cloak caught it.
"What are you doing?"
Merritt knew how stupid that sounded, but he could not believe what was happening even then.
"You'd never dare hang a fray."
Yellow Cloak laughed.
"That other one, the pimply boy, he said the same thing."
"He doesn't mean it. He cannot mean it. My father will pay you. I'm worth a good ransom, more than Pattaya, twice as much."
The singer sighed.
"Lord Walder might be half blind and gouty, but he's not so stupid as to snap at the same bait twice. Next time he'll send 100 swords instead of 100 dragons, I fear."
"He will."
Merritt tried to sound stern, but his voice betrayed him.
"He'll send 1,000 swords and kill you all."
"He has to catch us first."
The singer glanced up at poor Pattaya.
"And he can't hang us twice now, can he?"
He drew a melancholy air from the strings of his woodharp.
"Here now, don't soil yourself. All you need to do is answer me a question, and I'll tell them to let you go."
Merritt would tell them anything if it meant his life.
"What you want to know? I'll tell you true, I swear it."
The outlaw gave him an encouraging smile.
"Well, as it happens, we're looking for a dog that ran away."
"A dog?"
Merritt was lost.
"What kind of dog?"
"He answers to the name Sandor Clegane. Thor says he was making for the twins. We found the ferryman who took him across the Trident and the poor sod he robbed on the King's Road. Did you see him at the wedding, perchance?"
"The Red Wedding?"
Merritt's skull felt as if it were about to split, but he did his best to recall. There had been so much confusion. But surely someone would have mentioned Joffrey's dog sniffing around the twins.
He wasn't in the castle, not at the main feast. He might have been at the bastard feast, or in the camps, but no, someone would have said.
He would have had a child with him, said the singer. A skinny girl, about 10, or perhaps a boy the same age.
I don't think so, said Merritt. Not that I knew.
No, Arr, that's a pity. Well, up you go.
No, Merritt squealed loudly. No, don't. I gave you your answer. You said you'd let me go.
Oh, seems to me that what I said was, I tell them to let you go.
The singer looked at Yellowcloak.
Lem, let him go.
Go buggy yourself, the big outlaw replied brusquely. The singer gave Merritt a helpless shrug and began to play The Day They Hang Black Robin.
Peace!
The last of Merritt's courage was running down his leg.
I've done you no harm. I brought the gold the way you said. I answered your question. I have children.
That young wolf never will, said the one-eyed outlaw. Merritt could hardly think for the pounding in his head.
He shamed us. The whole realm was laughing. We had to cleanse the stain and our honour.
His father had said all that and more.
Maybe so. What do a bunch of bloody peasants know about a lord's honour?
Yellowcloak wrapped the end of the rope around his hand 3 times.
We know some about murder, though.
Not murder.
His voice was shrill.
It was vengeance. We had a right to our vengeance. It was war. Aegon, we called him Jinglebell. A poor lackwit never hurt anyone. Lady Stark cut his throat. We lost 50 men in the camps. Sir Garth Goodbrook, Kyrus' husband, and Sir Titus, Jared's son. Someone smashed his head in with an axe. Stark's direwolf killed 4 of our wolfhounds and tore the kennelmaster's arm off his shoulder, even after we'd filled him full of quarrels.
So you sewed his head on Rob Stark's neck after both of them were dead, said Yellowcloak.
My father did that. All I did was drink. You wouldn't kill a man for drinking.
Merritt remembered something then, something that might be the saving of him.
They say Lord Beric always gives a man a trial, that he won't kill a man unless something's proved against him. You can't prove anything against me. The Red Wedding was my father's work, and Ryman's and Lord Bolton's. Lothar rigged the tents to collapse and put the crossbowmen in the gallery with the musicians. Bastard Walder led the attack on the camps. They're the ones you want, not me. I only drank some wine. You have no witness.
As it happens, you're wrong there.
The singer turned to the hooded woman.
Milady?
The outlaws parted as she came forward, saying no word. When she lowered her hood, something tightened inside Merritt's chest, and for a moment he could not breathe.
No, I saw her die. She was dead for a day and a night before they stripped her naked and threw her body in the river. Raymond opened her throat from ear to ear. She was dead.
Her cloak and collar hid the gash his brother's blade had made, but her face was even worse than he remembered. The flesh had gone pudding soft in the water and turned the colour of curdled milk. Half her hair was gone, and the rest had turned as white and brittle as a crone's. Beneath her ravaged scalp, her face was shredded skin and black blood where she'd raked herself with her nails. But her eyes were the most terrible thing. Her eyes saw him, and they hated.
She don't speak, said the big man in the yellow cloak. You bloody bastards cut her throat too deep for that. But she remembers.
He turned to the dead woman and said,
What do you say, my lady? Was he part of it?
Lady Catelyn's eyes never left him. She nodded. Merritt Frey opened his mouth to plead, but the noose choked off his words.
His feet left the ground, the rope cutting deep into the soft flesh beneath his chin. Up into the air,